So this is Ryan Nilsson sitting with David Wildman. It's August 28th at the very end of our National Farm Worker Ministry Board meeting in Portland, Oregon. We're sitting in a dorm room at Portland State University, and I'd say it's about 10 till 10 a.m., so we'll get started. David, how did you first get involved with the National Farm Worker Ministry?
I first got involved with the ministry in 2001. When I took a new position with the United Methodist Church, and it was part of my responsibilities, so it was actually job-related. I'd certainly known a lot about farm workers before that, but that was the first time I was involved. Due to budget cuts, we actually weren't able to participate in meetings for a year or two there. It was pretty bad in 2001, 2002. So my first meeting was in Seattle, Washington, in the summer of 2003.
What was some of the, you said you'd been aware of farm worker issues before. Mm-hmm. What were some of the exposures you'd had before?
Well, I first got involved when I myself was a student in college, and there was a lettuce boycott, and I was introduced to some fellow students who had just gotten back from a year in Florida organizing with some of the farm workers with UFW, and then we were working on a campaign with the cafeteria at the college. So that was my first introduction, and then I kind of kept in touch in terms of, I never myself served in the fields, but was very active in boycott campaigns over the years.
Can you tell me how your job with the Methodist Church has, you said it's basically been your job to be involved, but why is that the position that the Methodist Church has for you to be involved with the ministry?
Well, the United Methodist Church, I think, has been involved with the concern about migrant workers, various farm workers, but other kinds of migrant workers as well, almost since it got started. John Wesley was visiting folks in the mines and had a very strong commitment to the concerns of what was happening in the lives of workers and how the church should be involved with that. So that goes back several centuries, but more particularly, local United Methodists have been involved in various migrant ministries that over the last, say, I don't know, since the 1920s or 30s, then led into what became the National Farm Worker Ministries. We've always had United Methodists that have been active with the ministries since 40 years ago when it officially got started, including some staff at various points. So my work with the Board of Global Ministries is in the area of human rights and racial justice. And certainly the issues facing farm workers are very much human rights issues around working conditions, wages, safety in the fields, the right to organize. But they're also racial justice issues because it's people of color that are being discriminated against systematically and exploited for their cheap labor and their vulnerable status oftentimes for those that are undocumented.
So there's this long tradition of it would be almost expected that the Methodist Church would be mm-hmm. involved with all this. From a more like personal perspective for you, how do your beliefs or values impact your work with the ministry, or with, I guess with the Methodist mm-hmm. Church generally, but with the National Farm Worker Ministry specifically?
Well, I think throughout Scripture, there's a four kind of areas of priority, and I went to seminary perhaps for too many years, so it's dangerous to read the Bible, but I think that that's one of the exciting challenges for us in the church, that repeatedly, story after story, from Genesis through Revelation, lift up the poor, the sojourners or aliens, or there's different English translations, but really migrant workers are a central part of the biblical stories. And God repeatedly is calling on the faith community to be in solidarity with and really take the lead from migrant workers. So Ruth and Naomi were both at one point in their lives migrant workers, and clearly they played a key role. Joseph was enslaved, so I think there's a close and fine line between slave labor and the experiences of folks enslaved literally and the forced labor of farm workers that are really slave-like conditions. And so I think that, you know, in a modern kind of world where I live in New York City, so like there's not a lot of farm work going on right in the city, but certainly in New York State, we've lost touch with the agricultural roots of the biblical stories and faith communities of how important that working the land, the relationship to the land, the relationship to one another, and the problems when landowners begin to exploit the folks that are doing the work. And so that's something I think we really need to constantly work on reconnecting churches with. But it, once you get past that first step, I think people make see the connections, and certainly if they've met farm workers or are in any context, they can't help but feel, I need to be involved.
You kind of said, we said a few things there. One of them that I'm particularly interested in from some of our other conversations was that there's a scriptural warrant for taking the lead from farm workers, not just being invested in the poor and interested, but in actually taking leadership. Can you expand on that?
Well, I think this, you know, Ruth and Naomi is one example of how, as migrant workers, not only their situation was lifted up, but how they took initiative in that situation to try and address the concerns. But Nehemiah, the fifth chapter, the people have kind of returned to the land and are beginning to kind of reestablish themselves after being displaced and dispossessed. So there's a migration thing, forced migration, if you will. And suddenly there's a dynamic of oppression within the community itself, of some people exploiting and forcing into enslaved forced labor others in the community. Now, that was one small community of the Hebrew people at that time, but I think the challenge is, if we understand ourselves all as children of God, repeatedly, over and over again, the situation of farm workers is that part of the family of God's children is dividing and exploiting sisters and brothers. And so how do we stand with them? The community organized. So Nehemiah took the lead from people complaining and then gathering together. And I think that is, you know, something that's hard for us. There's a lot of charity orientation. So, you know, and certainly there's a history within migrant ministries of churches of saying, let's go to the fields and provide water. Let's help out with housing. Those are critical issues. There's no question. But the step that's critical for the churches to take, I think, is to say, how do we listen to what farm workers are saying about their conditions? And out of their conditions, they are offering a model for us as a servant church on the way. They're forced to serve others all the time through their labor. But, you know, the examples of Cesar Chavez would be the modern-day example that is very biblically connected. Folks leading out of the fields to say, we have something to say to the powerful, and the powerful's faith may be restored only when they listen to and respond to the needs and cries and leadership of the farm workers.
You mentioned, well, I guess in other conversations, again, we talked a little bit about the diversity of the Methodist Church. And I wonder if your experience in working for the Methodist Church, if you found people to generally understand what you're saying now and to be supportive of the work of the National Farm Worker Ministry, or if that's been controversial at times, or I don't know.
All of the above. Without question, the Methodist Church is kind of spread across the political and theological spectrum. And there's been, I think, a concern for both stemming from Wesley, but also from the reading of the scripture and the church tradition of personal holiness and social holiness. And within that range, there are Methodists leaning one way or the other. The challenge, I think, is to hold on to both of those, that there's a strong pietistic faith of how do we live faithfully as individuals, but we always live in community. So that challenge is how do we express that social holiness, not just with the club or little immediate community of our local congregation, but the broader community. I've met United Methodists that run farms, and they will talk very faithfully about, oh, well, we would, you know, this couldn't be a problem on our farm of migrant laborers. And yet, there are problems. And so, there's challenges all around. I don't want to pretend it's easy. And so, there are places where there's a lot of resistance to that. The same with more broad migration issues of, like, in the United States right now, there's a big struggle around documentation. But I think that part of what we've tried to do is reclaim the notion from the Bible that migration is a part of human survival. That if there's a drought, if there's a flood, you will move. And then at some point you'll move back. But also in terms of the needs for work to provide for your family, that migration has been a part of human existence since recorded history. Why is it now that certain migration or certain peoples who move are seen as illegal or problematic and don't have rights versus others that move and it's seen as fine? So I think that's the challenge, and one of the things I've tried to do is really, in talking with congregations, begin to show how all of us migrate. So someone who retires from New York City and moves to Arizona or Florida is a migrant retiree, not a migrant worker. They're not working necessarily for paid work. So why are some migrants pitted against other migrants? And some are seen as like valued and welcome, and others are seen as unwelcome, or at least their rights are unwelcome. Their labor, the cheap labor, is very welcome. And that's, I think, one of the challenges is why are we taking the fruits and reaping in a kind of agricultural way as a society from cheap labor, but not also responding in terms of what, how do we cultivate and support the communities that are providing this food for us?
So the freedom to migrate is one example. What are some other ways in which you see the National Farm Workers Ministry working towards some sort of biblical vision for what for the future, or what's the hope, basically, both kind of ideally and practically, of the work of the ministry?
Mm-hmm. Well, for me, the National Farm Worker Ministries embodies the way the church should be living in the world better than many other organizations and expressions of the church, in that it's very clear that farm workers are always the ones on the front lines or out in the fields. They are the ones to take the lead. But it's as farm workers are organizing, whether it's the United Farm Workers, it's the Farm Labor Organizing Committee, FLOC, or Coalition of Mockley Workers, wherever it is a farm worker movement is coming together to demand better conditions, to express their own concerns. The National Farm Worker Ministries has been very clear. We take their lead and walk with them in solidarity and accompaniment to challenge the churches also to walk with farm workers. And I think that that very literal walking with, of being on the picket lines, being out in the fields, going into grocery stores to demand, college campuses with boycotts at various points, that all of that is reminding the church that we are to walk with and take the lead from those that are most vulnerable as they're organizing to change the situation. So it's not just somebody who's destitute and we want to help them, but to say we're standing with you to say this shouldn't stay this way and we should change the conditions so that all of us have decent wages, decent ways of contributing, and respect for human rights.
That's So since you've been on the board through your position with the Methodist Church, what have been some of your primary areas of involvement with the National Farm Worker Ministry? Which campaigns, or what's your role on the board?
I think primarily it's through the being present at the board meetings and then sharing some of the stories and the struggles. Being in New York City, we're not immediately connected with a lot of the farm worker struggles in North Carolina or in Florida, here in Oregon, where we are for, at this moment. So it's how to connect the broader community of churches with these stories. And so a lot of times it's just trying to get the stories from our gatherings when we meet with farm workers or even meet with growers or have meetings or picket lines to share those stories and get that word out to the wider number of churches. And I think this is where even if you're in California, being out in the fields is a big stretch from being in the suburbs of the cities. And so it's that challenge of bringing the voices from the fields. And reality is, farm workers are working long, long hours. And if they are taking a day off to meet with people, that's potentially jeopardizing their work. And so sometimes there is a real need to have groups like the Farmworker Ministries be able to share those stories with folks, just because it's not realistic for farmworkers themselves to travel around and drop everything. They do, of course, there are tours, and then we would support, you know, when the Coalition of Mockley Workers have done, you know, sort of organizing tours beyond Florida. But it's the personal stories that I think engage people more than the statistics. And so that's what we try and do, is lift up those personal stories. So.
Can you share a few of those personal stories that you might use in talking with churches? Maybe some that have had particular impacts on you, or provided insights into what's going on.
Well, we've gone to North Carolina a number of times, and the Mount Olive pickle boycott from the late 90s, early 2000s. Mount Olive is owned by a United Methodist. The CEO was United Methodist. And so there was a very strong connection there, and that's where I said, you know, in the past we had struggles. As a big corporate CEO, he commanded a lot of respect within the community of United Methodists in North Carolina. And yet there were other United Methodists who were like, wait a minute, you are one person, and you have a responsibility like anyone else to make sure fair wages are going on. And so there was a long struggle within the Methodist Church, as well as the struggle around the boycott. One of our meetings, and I forget, I think it was maybe 2004, we were in North Carolina and went to the fields and some of the camps where a lot of the guest workers are. And in going, some of the farm worker organizers showed us a map of North Carolina in 1860. And what were the counties in the state that had the highest percentage of enslaved African Americans? And then they showed right next to that a map of North Carolina in 2000 from the census, of which counties had the highest percentage of Latino population within the counties. They were almost identical. Now, part of that's those are the agricultural counties. But it was making the point that agricultural labor in 1860 was done by slaves. And agricultural labor today was done by farm workers, predominantly Latino, who were under not very much slave-like conditions in terms of working in the fields with pesticides, no protection, very harsh conditions. And as guest workers, for the ones that were guest workers, if they left those conditions, they would become, in effect, undocumented and be even more vulnerable to exploitation. When we got there, we met with some organizers who were actually arrested for speaking Spanish. And I think that that was kind of this such a bizarre thing that they had gone to the camp, and of course they were organizers with the union, but they weren't arrested around organizing issues. They were arrested because they were speaking Spanish and the police couldn't understand them. And they eventually got released, but it was just that notion that, like, the level of intimidation in the community to say, we don't want you meeting with the communities. And, you know, in farm labor camps, they're often very isolated. They don't have cars. They're dependent on a bus to, you know, kind of provided by the grower to get them from their, you know, kind of like camps where they stay, which is really lousy conditions in terms of just sanitation and things like that, to the fields and back again. And then maybe once a week, if they're lucky, they're taken to a store where they can get some food and things like that. And so it's very invisible to even the folks, their neighbors in North Carolina, let alone the rest of the country. And people coming in and talking with them about the conditions and sharing what was happening in other camps was critical to farm workers coming together and saying, wait a minute, we don't have to accept these conditions. We can fight against this, and sharing their stories. And the police did not want, and the growers did not want, folks speaking Spanish and those stories getting out. And so they got arrested, but that then became turned around. That intimidation was so grossly unjust that even folks who were not necessarily supportive of farm workers were like, well, why should somebody be arrested for speaking Spanish?
What was the actual charge? I mean, speaking Spanish.
Yeah, they were communicating in a way that the police couldn't understand. And I don't remember the exact charge. It ended up getting a drop. But the point was that by being arrested, that got them out of the situation. and created a hostile environment and intimidating climate. So, you know, the reality is oftentimes whether the charge is sustained or not, it's the climate of fear that is sustained is the message. Like, don't talk with outsiders or you may get in trouble. And so one of the concerns was that the farm workers couldn't necessarily leave to another place. So if they were seen as meeting with anyone from the union or even outside folks that were coming in to support their organizing efforts, they would get in trouble. And that was kind of the message of this. And so it was, how are we going to challenge that and get that story out to others?
This next question will be a pretty big one. You might want to answer me through stories and anecdotes to some degree, like you talked about North Carolina, but I'm curious, you've already commented on your kind of being in New York City, the particularity of your regional perspective, and working with a national board like this and hearing stories from Florida and California and Oregon and North Carolina. Can you comment on how you see the work of the ministry as different in different regions of the country in supporting the farm worker movement?
Well, certainly, I'll say, you know, boycotts are one strategy. And so, like, in relation to North Carolina, the Mount Olive pickle boycott was to challenge a company that was the biggest purchaser of cucumbers for the pickles, to say, put pressure on the growers to come to, and that was the first, out of that process that I talked about earlier, came the first kind of three-way agreement. Now, there's still lots of struggles, and just having signing a contract, this is not the same as implementing things. So, depending on the actual agricultural products, sometimes the products steer the kind of organizing and also the kinds of exploitative conditions that are faced. So grapes are going to be different than an annual crop. So when you need pruning and other kind of maintaining of a product like grapes, that's very different than lettuce. That's, you know, seasonal. The same with orchards. So, like, you know, here in Portland, meeting with some of the folks that are in orchards where you have apples and others, cherries that are around for years, and you have to have a kind of relationship that's different. So that's certainly one shape. I think that there's different dynamics in different countries. You know, Florida is the largest agricultural, California is the largest agricultural sector. So it's big business. But there's also a very large Latino population. So that plays itself differently than in North Carolina, where the Latino population is still quite small in relation to the rest of the North Carolina population. So there, again, there's some difference in terms of organizing and outreach. How supportive the local churches is another matter. Oftentimes, I know for the United Methodists most supportive initially with the farm worker struggles in North Carolina were not ones in North Carolina, but were outside of North Carolina, maybe that had been working with farm workers in Florida or in California to say, wait a minute, here's another struggle that's very similar, and I've learned from that. Now, I will say in New York, we have a large immigrant population. So a huge percentage of New Yorkers are foreign-born. So there are some commonalities of experiences, and there's lots of exploited migrant labor, but it's in restaurants, it's in sweatshops. And so for me, one of the exciting challenges with National Farm Worker Ministries is to take the insights of farm workers and their struggles from rural areas and then connect that with what's similar and what's different with the struggles of immigrants that are working in a sweatshop in Chinatown. And I think that that's a very fruitful conversation and way of kind of connecting between the different struggles, the different models of organizing that you have. A factory can work 24/7, but, you know, when the sun goes down, like, there's some limits as to how much you can, you know, work in the fields. But on the other hand, the fields are outside, so, you know, heat stroke and the issues that are facing farm workers still that are dying in the fields because they aren't able to get water, aren't appropriate shade. Sometimes that humanitarian component becomes an entry point for churches that don't understand where their food comes from. But the other thing is, everybody uses food every day. So that, you know, there's, I think, a built-in component to connect folks with farm workers that maybe isn't the same thing with clothing or sweatshops or with other kinds of exploitation or restaurants. Some folks won't go to restaurants that often, so it's harder to connect of how do you organize.
Typically people use, I hope, are wearing clothing every day. Maybe not.
But not necessarily purchasing it every day.
For sure. Whereas we consume food every day. Can you comment on, you're talking about the diversity of the Methodist Church and how those churches in North Carolina weren't actually initially supportive or maybe mm-hmm. at all of the Mount Olive pickle boycott. Can you comment on how you go into speaking with congregations or church leaders differently in a context like North Carolina in the South, where maybe there's reunion is a bad word compared to how you might go in with a Methodist church in New York that is more I don't know, more progressive culture, yeah. at least more openly open to labor.
Well, I think one of the key things is to break through a lot of the bad rhetoric or misconceptions that are posed through the media, and there's a lot of anti-union sentiment in U.S. culture generally. The union movement overall, not just farm workers, is probably at one of its lowest points in close to 100 years. So you have now maybe 12% of the workforce, and most of that is in the public sector. So in the private sector, it's even less. It's less than 10%. Whereas at one point in the 50s, you had, you know, sort of half of workers were unionized. Very different dynamic. So people don't have that immediate experience. I often frame it as looking at the right to organize and not necessarily unions per se. But should workers have an opportunity to come together and talk about the concerns that they share and raise those in a collective voice? And I say, just imagine if Christians did not have an opportunity to gather together to talk about our faith and express our concerns. We would call that religious persecution. We would be very opposed to that if that's denied. And there are places in the world where that is denied in a systematic fashion. So in the same way, I've said, you know, what are we really challenging? I mean, a union official that maybe is corrupt is not saying that the right to organize of workers should be denied. And what I found is that when you frame it in this right to organize and come together as a community and be able to give voice to your own concerns yourself, that begins to break through. Now, the reality is that there's still power dynamics, United Methodist and every church, that folks will know somebody personally. And if that person is a corporate manager or maybe a large farmer, then that's going to affect some of their decisions because personal relationships are so important to how we express and live out our faith and our values, not just, you know, principles. And I think that those personal relationships are important. If they don't know any farm workers, then there's a distance there that it may seem like they're just a statistic. And I think that's why the personal stories are so important. And the National Farm Worker Ministries provides people within the faith community that are walking with farm workers all the time. And so, you know, from New York, I can't do that. And many churches can't do that. But through the ministries, by sharing these stories, it's like, no, there are always folks that are there, that are present. And let's lift those stories up and connect people to them to then say, how do we organize together, workers and churches coming together?
Are there any other stories that come to mind of personal interactions with farm workers that are stories that would recur in when you're talking to groups and trying to get them into this mindset of kind of the humanity of these workers?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, there was that terrific campaign of Take Our Jobs, which, you know, it's kind of like, please, look, you think this is so easy? Like, please, do it, you know, add Colbert when he offered, just like, yeah, I'll do a day in, when he interviewed Arturo Rodriguez as the head of United Farm Workers. And I think that notion of what does it mean to walk in someone else's shoes and to just challenge folks, you know, I know what it's like to just kind of walk down the street on a hot day. And we all think about how we need to kind of air condition our environment, whether we're in the car or in an office or at home. And here are folks out in the fields and engaged in really backbending hard labor. And I think that something that gives people that sense, and then not having water and the pressure of time to, you know, if it's a piece rate, like how many tomatoes you pick. So I think it's those tangible comparisons. The other thing, I think the coalition of Immokalee workers, where it was kind of 1 penny a pound, would you know, and that's a kind of like a very easy, you know, would you be willing to, you know, contribute one more penny? And yet the difference that that made in terms of nearly doubling wages for farm workers was an entry point for folks to just recognize that these are small, they're not making huge demands, actually. They are making very modest demands about respect that will have significant impact in their lives, but with very little downside for consumers. In fact, there's a big upside. If you realize that food is well produced, then safety issues in terms of pesticides affect both farm workers and consumers. And so I think it's at each point trying to just humanize the connections that we are in this together, and some of those stories draw us closer than others. The pesticide stuff, you know, is just horrendous. I'll also say that, you know, for United Methodists, we are a global church. So about 35% of United Methodists are African, Filipino, European. And certainly in Africa, in the Congo, in Mozambique, in Angola, in West Africa, in Liberia, in Sierra Leone, where we have a lot of United Methodists, many are working in agricultural communities, and maybe they're small farmers instead of farm workers, but they're facing the same kinds of issues of this push for export crops that are being sent somewhere else, so they are growing food that they themselves cannot eat. In the Philippines as well, I visited banana plantations and pineapple plantations and seen how workers, they would spray the crops in the fields while the workers were there. And so they were facing very similar conditions in another country and in a global context, but to begin to kind of make those connections is really important. And when I shared with workers in the Philippines the conditions of workers in the fields in the United States, they were like, these were poor, poor workers, and they were like, oh my God, we had no idea. And so they began to feel this solidarity and this need to say, you know, our struggle is the struggle of this, of the farm workers, the campesinos, in the United States as well. And they couldn't ever make that journey. And so I think a responsibility and obligation of the church and those of us in positions of serving the larger church need to tell those stories and make those connections locally and globally.
You've been talking about making connections and sharing stories with people in churches. Are there times when you've seen some really significant transitions or transformations in the way that people think and respond to this issue? Are there particular stories about times when this really worked? You're kind of representing the ministry and going in and telling the stories of farm workers and trying to call people to get involved in some way.
Yeah, I mean, there's constant little victories. Of, you know, certainly like the whole Mount Olive pickle boycott and campaign.
Victory.
Yeah, a little victory. And and I think that, like, you know, oftentimes we have this all or nothing approach in our culture in the United States. So the notion that a victory is one step in a journey. And so there can be several steps backwards afterwards, and there's certainly been struggles in North Carolina in the fields. Taco Bell is another thing. You know, so there was this huge victory with Taco Bell around tomatoes in Florida. But there are still large tomato consumers, companies that are resisting that. And so it's like the struggle continues, but we still need to celebrate when it is that some of the most powerful people in the world have stopped and changed their practices, primarily because of the leadership and the insistence of farm workers. And I've got to say that when I've talked to folks in the peace movement or other human rights movements and people are feeling kind of discouraged, or in the immigrant rights movement, I said, like, now look, the leadership of the Taco Bell campaign and the leadership of the Mount Olive Pickle campaign were farm workers, many of them undocumented. So if undocumented Latino workers that are about as marginalized and oppressed with very few resources in a climate that's hostile to immigrants can nevertheless affect change from multi-billion dollar corporations, then there certainly is a God. There is, you know, the weak do shame the strong, as Paul says in 1 Corinthians. And that God repeatedly chooses the weak to say, we've turned God's values and God's creation upside down as a society. And they are taking the lead in turning it right side up again. It doesn't stay right side up, or it doesn't get all the way, but to celebrate those things. And what I found is that in especially white middle-class churches, we've lost the notion largely of what it means to celebrate. And so I found that it's in introducing middle-class churches to the struggles of farm workers that they suddenly not only learn about justice, but they also learn about what does it mean to have a joyful faith. And hope is something that, like, has no evidence that this is likely at all. It's not like optimism or something that I think things are going to go well. But really, like, in the face of growers, oftentimes folks that are armed, and that they could lose their jobs, and someone who talks with the union reps suddenly is found like they're fired the next day, that in those conditions, nevertheless, that community of farm workers is far better equipped to celebrate the joy that we have living day to day and the moments when we come together and things change than middle-class communities with far more resources but fear that they might lose those resources and that safety and security they think that comes from that middle-class standard. So to my sense, many of the churches are kind of imprisoned in a kind of middle-class cultural captivity, if you will, and we need, for a self-interested thing, to connect with farm workers and others that are marginalized, and it's in working together that we discover that common joy of being around the table together.
You already began touching on it, but I was hoping to ask about how you see your work with the National Farm Worker Ministry is connecting to what I know is a lot of your other work in the peace movement. Mm-hmm. And you're also kind of bringing in this dynamic of, middle-class conscientiousization, yeah. Or coming to consciousness, something more than kind of the lives that they're living. But can you comment on how your work with the peace movement, your work with the farm worker ministry and the farm worker movement have complemented one another, fed into?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think certainly in the, corporations have huge influence in the political process in the United States today and frankly in the world. And the approach is really to, I think, shift the notion of human rights into shareholder rights. And so if you think about one of the exercises that I've done with churches in just kind of educational settings and workshops is to kind of look at the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and say, what would happen if you replace every person has the right to decent work and a living wage and change that to every dollar has the right, or freedom of movement, like every person has the right of freedom of movement to every dollar. And in fact, if you look at free trade agreements, they are to ensure the right of dollars, and those obviously who hold those dollars, to move from one country to another, from one investment to another. And so that globalization and that organization of money, the right to organize, is certainly, money is seen as having a right to organize. So I think that these values have gotten turned upside down, and what's really confusing for folks that don't work on this all the time is there's a language of it that sounds, you can talk about rights, but like a corporation is not an individual, even though U.S. law at the moment, and the Supreme Court seems to be kind of making that mistake. It's human beings that we need to constantly rehumanize this and go back to our sisters and brothers and understand the biblical notion. But that's a constant challenge, and I think it's a constant educational process. What I found is that farm workers often can remind us of the agricultural roots, if you will, of many of the biblical stories. And so they get it because they're working day to day with crops. So, you know, images of everyone in Micah 4 talks about they shall beat their swords into plowshares. One of the things that's invariably happened, not just in the day of swords, but today, is when more and more resources go to making war, there's less time, there's less resources to pruning the trees, to plowshares. And there's a direct consequence in terms of agriculture and sustainability in the food industry. So that swords and plowshares thing that's been very powerful as a biblical scripture for the peace movement. And in New York, or across the street from the United Nations, there's the Isaiah wall that they shall beat their swords into plowshares. Well, Micah goes on to say, and everyone shall live under their own vine and their own fig tree, and no one shall make them afraid. Well, if you look at the situation of farm workers, they're being intimidated. They don't own the land. And in many cases, it's small farmers from Mexico, from Central America, who've been pushed off the land by large corporations and by governments and been forced to kind of move. So now they're still doing agricultural work, but instead of on their own land, they're doing that work for someone else. And Micah reminds us, no, the image and intent of God is that each of us would be able to kind of grow the food that we need to sustain ourselves, our families, our immediate communities. So a lot of the local, you know, you think about now, there's a movement for eating local and producing local. And so folks are looking for what's the green market, the farmer's market that I can kind of connect to in New York. So in the summer season, are there products that come from within 100 miles or so that I can make available? Well, that's beginning to kind of open an entry point from a consumer standpoint to the realities of what would that look like for the farm workers as well and the folks who work the land. And I think it's a constant effort of, like, how do we bring folks back together to see our common connections? It's not easy because much of society pushes us away from each other. So I don't want to pretend it's, you know, at all easy, but I found that when folks are willing to take time to listen, and then there's a really important part of this for me is that if you tell folks how bad things are in the fields, but don't give folks a sense of, well, where am I able to step in? What's something I can do? Then a lot of folks are just like, you know, I'd like to hear, but I can't, I've got enough stress in my life. I'm struggling with just whether I'll keep my job or not and how to provide for my family. But if you tell me something concrete that I can be a part of, and I hear a way that I can actually connect and do something, and that's where I think the boycott campaigns are terrific. You know, it's not stop eating. It's stop buying one product to send a message of support and solidarity, and to urge a company to say, you need to change your practices. And then realize that that does lead to victories at times. It's a huge move. I mean, boycott campaigns take huge efforts. So the fact that they're not as many right now, I think is a sign partly of the recognition by unions, especially the farm worker movements, that you don't enter something like this lightly, because a failed boycott or one that just calls for something and people don't step in is more disempowering, especially for the farm workers. So you want to pick your campaigns wisely of what really there's some vulnerability for some real change to take place, even if it's just one step in a much longer struggle. But there's a lot of lessons from being a part of that for churches. And I would say in that a lot of churches right now have gotten Micah 6:8 kind of backwards. I don't know if the church is dyslexic, but it says to do justice and to love mercy and to walk humbly with God. And a lot of the church loves justice and does mercy. That's not what Micah calls us to do. They love to hear about justice, so they'll do a film screening. They will do an event. And then the outcome of the event may be, well, let's plan another event. And then the actions are food pantries and direct service, all of which is very important. But if it's not tied to what is the doing justice component, then we've fallen short of what it is God's calling us to do. And I think that's where the organizing efforts of farm workers and the unions have been critical to remind folks, and the National Farm Worker Ministries really works to remind churches, is look, the church is an organized community. It's not just an event. And so too, the farm worker movements and the churches walking with them are organizing movements, not one-time events.
That seems key. And I really like the way you frame that. The church is dyslexia. And several other answers to these questions, and I guess maybe even the way my questions are framed, we're talking about people kind of changing, coming to more appropriate consciousness of where their food comes from, the people behind it, the labor movement. It seems like you were raised in a context where a lot of this perspective of Christianity and understanding of some of these biblical principles from the prophets was pretty natural. But was there a point where things really did begin to click, or there was a big transition in your understanding of the work of the National Farm Worker Ministry, for instance? Or I think it sounds pretty obvious that by the time you got to the position you're in, where you were sitting on our board,
yeah,
this was already your persuasion, your understanding of Christianity, at least. But was there a story you can tell about how you came to that perspective? You're just born with it.
No, I think, coming from New York, there's a saying that many folks use of, how do you get to Carnegie Hall? Practice, practice, practice. And so I think one of the things that I've learned is to just ask, do a time inventory in our lives and say, if as a parent with children or as someone who's a young person that's growing up, what does most of your time go towards? And I've asked this especially around high school students, because I've done a lot of work with high school students, to say, so in a given week, how many are involved in music? So I asked about music. And then how many are involved in sports of some kind? And usually there's a lot of hands. So in asking them, then what does most of your time go towards in music or sports? The answer is usually practice. The game is only one day a week or a couple, but there's a lot of practice. You don't just decide to step on the stage at Carnegie Hall and perform. You have a lot of hard work. So then I ask them, we as a society and we as families and we as the church have devoted huge time and energy and resources and sacrifices to creating space in the week, each week, week after week, for music and for sports for our children and the children in our community. Where's the practice time for doing justice, for making peace? Now, I think there is, but have we claimed it as that, to say that, if we really want to be faithful and do justice and love mercy, then where's our practice time for doing that? And so for me, probably one of the most key things is my parents were both very faithful and deeply rooted in Scripture in terms of their living their faith. So that obviously had an impact. But we went, when I was growing up, to Riverside Church in New York City, which is a interdenominational, interracial, and international congregation. It's not your typical church. But we live 35 miles away in a very homogenous, white, upper middle class suburb. So I grew up experiencing the most racially diverse moment of my week was Sunday morning at church. Now, W.B. Du Bois, 100 years ago or so, said that Sunday morning is perhaps the most segregated hour in the United States, and it still is. So by my parents' choices in terms of church and where to go, my most racially diverse moment in my life was not school, it was not the workplace, it was not my community where I lived, it was church. And that stayed with me. And it was a church committed to social justice and a church committed to peace. And that rubbed off. And so I had plenty of practice time of that justice happens when we are in diverse communities and connecting with folks that are not speaking the same language necessarily or not coming from the same background and experiences. And so then it was very logical to say, of course, I've never worked on a farm, but I've got to connect with farm workers. Why? Because that's where church can be found. That's where God's presence is most alive, if you will. Not just farm workers, but, you know. And so I've always been supported in some sense, I think, and affirmed that when we stretch out to those places where that beyond our comfort zones, beyond the immediate community, that's the very place that we find God. Hebrews invites us to say, you know, Jesus suffered outside the gate. So it was out, you know, when he was crucified. The crucifixions were outside of the gate of the city, where the Romans kind of sent a political message to the community of intimidation. And Hebrews invites us to say, we need to also go to Jesus outside the gate. Well, that's the place where farm workers would be living in first century Palestine. That's the place where the landless are. That's not the place where the comfortable and the powerful are. And I think that that constant invitation is one that as we begin to kind of experience those things in our lives. So for me, it was just easier, I think, that the church was not segregated. It was integrated in my own experience. And so I've tried to kind of find that in many places.
What would you say to people who may be considering being involved with the National Farm Worker Ministry today?
To use a advertising phrase, just do it. I think it'll be great. It'll change your life, and you will be part of an amazing community of people. The farm workers themselves, the National Farm Worker Ministries, I think, is one of the greatest examples of right now, especially multi-generational organizing. So you have folks in their 80s and even 90s that have been doing amazing work for decades of being out there at, you know, grocery stores and supermarkets and handing out little flyers about boycotts and talking to officials and challenging the companies and walking in the fields with the workers and with the union. They're at it, like, for the long term. And then you have young people on college campuses and in churches that are saying, you know, we've got to be working on this. And how can those communities learn from each other? And that, to me, is one of the great strengths of National Farm Worker Ministries, is it's a place where the generations can learn. We don't always do so well. I don't want to, you know, the National Farm Worker Ministries is not perfect. But a 40th anniversary is a place to celebrate and remember that it's been a place where folks of different ages and from different parts of the country repeatedly come together and learn from working together with one another and with farm workers. And I think to have board members and active parts of the ministry who themselves grew up as farm workers and now are working in positions in cities or professional jobs, remember those roots. To other folks who kind of were farmers, grew up on a farm, a family farm, and now are connected, and then others who are completely urban, you know, have no connection really to the agricultural industry other than being consumers. That's a delightful sense of the beloved community, of how we live that day to day with farm workers and with one another.
Great answer. Are there any other comments you'd like to make or stories you'd like to tell before we close this?
I think there's a lot. This is, you know, being here in Oregon was kind of seeing, it was fascinating to me. kind of seeing the context of what's seen as kind of a, you know, the West Coast, it's more progressive political environment. You know, hearing kind of the stories. And I think one of the challenges is how can we get growers and small farmers to step out of the kind of industrial corporate mindset and see the common interests that they have. And my first meeting was also out on the West Coast. It was in Washington, but it was with some of the similar kind of orchards around here. And there was one individual farmer who said, you know, under this kind of free trade agreement and stuff with apples, like trying to figure out what could we do to have a market, a fair trade apple where workers would get good wages, where growers as a farmer could also kind of make a living. And he was like, you know, the distributors are just screwing us all. Because he said, like, I can't pay the workers that well. And then when I get there, there's preset prices that limit, like, whether I can keep going with these orchards. And, you know, with an orchard, if you don't keep going, you lose the productivity. It's not like you choose to kind of let fields lie fallow for lettuce or something like that. And that, to me, was a symbol early on of, like, the globalization of agriculture. And so that all of the organizing in California or all of the organizing here is also connected to the fact that apples are not just grown out here, they're grown in New York, but they're also grown in Mexico. This is a global market now. And corporations can move quite readily from one country to another, from one fruit to another, from one product to another. It's a lot harder for workers and communities to do the same. And so I think the challenge now is really, and the ministry is wrestling with this, is what does it mean to really engage with a global production system, but maintain the integrity of local struggles. Years ago, there was a friend of mine who was working actually with, it was an auto assembly plant. And, you know, for years, the church has learned the lesson of, like, you have to think globally and act locally. And he said, you know, no amount of global analysis and thinking and no amount of local action was going to keep that factory from closing and moving to Mexico. He suddenly said the workers realized, and he is a kind of organizer from the faith community, realized that we also have to think locally about what are the conditions that are good for our community and the needs that we face and act globally. And I think that's beginning to happen, that the farm workers are saying, you know, we have to have organizing going on in Mexico as well as in the U.S. But we also need to be in touch with campesino movements. Now, not that any one organization can't do that, but I think how can we keep learning from one another and begin to understand that we're already in all these places. So as corporations are thinking about, do we grow the apples in the Northwest or do we grow the apples in Chile, the church is already there. The church is a global organization. Now, we're not always on speaking terms with each other, sadly. But how can we tap into that global community that we have to say, you know, if farm workers are facing struggles here, and this is, you know, in 1 Corinthians 12, Paul talks about we're all members of the same body. And if one member's suffering, we're all suffering. And if one member rejoices, we all rejoice. And so I think the challenge, and I think why being involved in the National Farm Worker Ministries is such a joy and a privilege, is that we begin to connect the different parts of the body across the country here in the United States, but also globally. And that's just a really exciting journey to be a part of. And it's a way that faith keeps being lived out day to day for each of us. And so I hope folks will join that journey because we got another 40 years ahead of us, I'm sure, at least in terms of the struggle for justice.
Thank you so much for your time this morning. Yeah.
Thanks.